Exodus 4:18-5:20. The sixth talk in a series on Exodus was presented by David Crabtree on May 5, 1996 at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 1996. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction, all other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
I'm going to finish up chapter 4 and get into chapter 5 today. God doesn't seem to have been very smart. Picked a leader who didn't want to lead and a people that didn't want to go in staging an exodus. There had to be some convincing done on both parts, in both instances, to get them to cooperate. Moses had fled to the desert to escape the Pharaoh after he had killed an Egyptian. And while in Egypt, he apparently lost his confidence. So when God appears to him in the burning bush, Moses doesn't really want to be the leader that God is asking him to be. And so when God appears to him in the bush and says, "I want you to go lead my people out of Egypt," he has a number of complaints and a number of things, excuses why he doesn't think that he should do it. He starts out by asking, "Who am I?" Implying that he's not up to the task, he's not able. And God's response to that is, "I will be with you." So then Moses comes back with the next excuse, the next concern, "Who are you?" And apparently his thinking is, "Are you able?" And God's response, if I understand it correctly, is essentially to say, "I am the sovereign God. I'm the one who made this universe. I'm the one who controls this universe. Yes, I'm able." So Moses' third concern is, "How can they know that you sent me?" And God gives him three signs that he can perform, three miracles to perform to indicate to the people of Israel that this is indeed Yahweh that has sent Moses. Then his fourth concern is that he's flawed. He is imperfect in speech. And God's response to that is, "I know. I made you that way. This isn't a glitch. This is, your things are right on plan. You're exactly what I want." And then God, Moses' response after those things, after listing his concerns, is to say, "Send someone else." Let me see, where are we? Verse 13 of chapter 4. This is Moses' response after God had said that the speech defect was not a problem. Moses says, "Please, Lord, now send the message by whomever thou wilt." Apparently indicating someone else, whomever else thou wilt. "Then the anger of the Lord burned against Moses, and he said, 'Is there not your brother Aaron, the Levite? I know that he speaks fluently. And moreover, behold, he is coming out to meet you. And when he sees you, he will be glad in his heart. And you are to speak to him and put the words in his mouth. And I, even I, will be with your mouth and his mouth. And I will teach you what you are to do.'" So, this is the first time that it indicates that God became angry. The other four concerns, God was willing to deal with. But now, we're dealing with not a concern, but rather a refusal. He's not willing to do it. And at that point, God becomes angry. Because this is the man that God has picked. This is the man that he wants to do it. And he's not willing to accept a refusal. Now, what God, even though he's not willing to allow Moses to back out of this and to allow the speech defect to be an excuse. God is willing to make a provision for it. God is willing to do something about it, to take care of that problem. And his solution is Aaron will be the spokesman. God will speak directly to Moses. Moses will instruct Aaron, and Aaron will speak to the people. In verse 16, he makes it clear what the relationship will be. Moreover, he shall speak for you to the people, that is, Aaron will speak for you to the people, and it shall come about that he shall be as a mouth for you, and you shall be as God to him. So Moses is going to be this representative of God. Moses is the one that God speaks to directly. Aaron, then, is going to give that to the people. Aaron's going to be the intermediary. So it's an interesting situation that God has set up, and I think, obviously, something that he had planned from the beginning. That the speech defect, then, becomes a reason for Aaron to be the spokesman. And Aaron is not your brother Aaron the Levite. Aaron, who comes from the family of Levi, then, will be this intermediary. And then we will find out later that it's the descendants of Aaron that become the priesthood. So he's setting up kind of a model for what it means to play this role of an intermediary between a representative of God and the people. So God is building into their experience these pictures. Pictures that become models to understand other things that will come along later. And that seems to be a common pattern with God, of creating these pictures in reality that help us to understand later things that he has to say and reveal to us. Okay, and then he says, And you shall take in your hand this staff with which you shall perform the signs. So, Moses consents to take on the responsibility, reluctantly, but he consents to do so. Verse 18 through 23. Then Moses departed and returned to Jethro, his father-in-law, and said to him, "Please let me go, that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt, and see if they are still alive." And Jethro said to Moses, "Go in peace." Now the Lord said to Moses in Midian, "Go back to Egypt, for all the men who were seeking your life are dead." So Moses took his wife and his sons and mounted them on a donkey, and he returned to the land of Egypt. Moses also took the staff of God in his hand. And the Lord said to Moses, "When you go back to Egypt, see that you perform before Pharaoh all the wonders which I have put in your power. But I will harden his heart so that he will not let the people go. Then you shall say to Pharaoh, 'Thus says the Lord, Israel is my son, my firstborn. So I said to you, let my son go, that he may serve me. But you have refused to let him go. Behold, I will kill your son, your firstborn.'" So Moses is agreeable to go and do this thing that God has asked him to do. The first thing he does is he asks permission from Jethro. And I assume that that's a cultural requirement. He asks permission from Jethro that he may return to Egypt. And Jethro grants him permission. Now it's interesting here. It's something that I don't want to belabor, but it is interesting that the reason that he gives is that I may return to my brethren who are in Egypt and see if they are still alive. He's obviously not telling Jethro the whole story. There is more to it. And yet that's as much as he divulges to Jethro. And apparently then, a period of time lapses. He asks for permission to leave. And then apparently a period of time lapses until he actually heads back to Egypt. And it's not until after God tells him to go back to Egypt because the people that had sought him, the Pharaoh, is no longer alive. So Moses sets out. Notice it says his sons. He apparently has more than one son at this point. The only thing that we've seen recorded so far was the birth of the one son. So the other son's birth is not recorded, and it's not clear when that occurred. And they take off. Now, God warns Moses that things are not going to go smoothly. Pharaoh is going to resist. And that Moses should anticipate this. And that resistance is not something that God can't handle. In fact, the resistance is something that he is doing. And God has a plan for overcoming that resistance, and it will come down to killing the firstborn of the Pharaoh, because Pharaoh will not let God's firstborn go, that is, his people. Now, verses 24 through 26 are very strange. I don't know what's going on here. It follows right after this discussion of what will happen, what it's going to take to overcome the resistance of Pharaoh, and that is killing Pharaoh's firstborn. Verse 24. Now it came about at the lodging place on the way that the Lord met him and sought to put him to death. Then Zipporah took a flint and cut off her son's foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. And she said, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." So he let him alone. At that time she said, "You are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." It's not clear which son needed to be circumcised. It's not clear how old the son is when this occurs. It is possible that this son was just born. God had told Abraham many, many years prior to this that the sons, when they were born, were to be circumcised on the eighth day. And that was supposed to be a requirement for all of the descendants of Abraham. It's not clear the extent to which that commandment was followed while the people were living in Egypt and in slavery. You would think that Moses would have been inclined to keep that commandment. His parents seemed to be people of faith. You would think that he would have learned from them the commandments that they were to keep and would have kept them. So it's not clear what's going on here. At least it's not clear to me. It looks suspicious that his wife was resistant to the circumcision. And the only reason I say that is because it sounds like there is bitterness in her voice in 25. That there's reluctance to perform the circumcision until Moses is on the verge of death. She cuts off the foreskin and threw it at Moses' feet. One of the aggravating things about the Old Testament narrative is it doesn't tell you the feelings. It doesn't tell you what is motivating this act. Does she think that she is... Is it an act of, I've got to perform this operation, and I have to get the foreskin to Moses' feet, and that's what will heal him or something? Or is it she's mad? It's not clear. And all we can do is reconstruct from the clues that we have, and that's difficult here. But my suspicion is that it's an act of anger. Because she says, "You are indeed a bridegroom of blood to me." And then later she says, "You are a bridegroom of blood because of the circumcision." In any case, God had decided that he was going to afflict Moses and bring him to the point of death in order to force him to circumcise his son. Apparently, which he did. Now, it doesn't indicate here, but Moses' wife and the two sons stay in the desert. They do not go back to Egypt with him. It isn't until much later in Exodus 18:2 that they're rejoined with Moses. Why did Moses leave his family in the desert? I don't know. Whether it's just a practical matter, that he knows that things are going to be difficult and it's better to leave them there. Whether Zipporah refused to identify with the Israelites and their suffering. And that maybe that's a part of why she didn't want to circumcise her son. I don't know. This is one of these strange sections of scripture that I find extremely difficult to unravel. Verse 27. Now the Lord said to Aaron, "Go to meet Moses in the wilderness." So he went and met him at the mountain of God, and he kissed him. And Moses told Aaron all the words of the Lord with which he had sent him, and all the signs that he had commanded him to do. Then Moses and Aaron went and assembled all the elders of the sons of Israel. And Aaron spoke all the words which the Lord had spoken to Moses. He then performed the signs in the sight of the people. So the people believed. And when they heard that the Lord was concerned about the sons of Israel, and that they had that he had seen their affliction, then they bowed low and worshipped. Aaron had already been coming out to meet Moses when God was sending him back to Egypt. Apparently it wasn't too hard to escape from Egypt. Moses did it, and now Aaron does it. But God had already arranged for Aaron to come out. They met at the mountain of God, a place that we've seen a couple times already and we'll see again. And Moses informs Aaron of all that God has told him, brings him up to speed. So now Aaron is knowledgeable about what God is doing and able to be a spokesman. They go back to Egypt, assemble all of the Israelites, tell them what God is up to, show them the signs, and the people believe. This is they bowed low and worshipped. There have been studies done on revolutions. It used to be thought that revolutions in a country occur when conditions become their worst. And so you can look at any society and see where things get really, really, really bad. And when they get down at their low point, then the people rebel. But subsequently, other studies have been done that indicate that that's not the dangerous part. That's not the dangerous time in a society. But rather, it's when things have been very, very bad, and then things begin to improve. And the problem is, the expectations always outstrip the progress that can be made in a realistic period of time. So it's called the J curve on the graph of expectations. Now, Moses has just told the Israelites what's going to happen. And he has therefore set into motion rising expectations. The Israelites are thinking, God has finally listened to us. God is finally ready to take some action and do something. And as a result, you can just sense the feeling of hope, the feeling that, aha, things are going to turn around now. But as we see in chapter 5, that's not exactly the route that God chose to take. Chapter 5, verse 1 through 5. And afterward, Moses and Aaron came and said to Pharaoh, "Thus says the Lord, the God of Israel, let my people go, that they may celebrate a feast to me in the wilderness." But Pharaoh said, "Who is the Lord that I should obey his voice to let Israel go? I do not know the Lord, and besides, I will not let Israel go." Then they said, "The God of the Hebrews has met with us. Please let us go a 3 days' journey into the wilderness, that we may sacrifice to the Lord our God, lest he fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. But the king of Egypt said to them, Moses and Aaron, why do you draw the people away from their work? Get back to your labors. Again, Pharaoh said, look, the people of the land are now many, and you would have them cease from their labors. So Moses appears before Yahweh, before Pharaoh, and says, let us go celebrate a feast to Yahweh. Now here, all he's asking for is the 3 days. And why that's what he's asking for, I don't know. But he asks, here, the first time, it's just, let us celebrate a feast in the wilderness. So they just want to get out of Egypt and celebrate this feast to Yahweh. Pharaoh's response is, who's Yahweh? Obviously, his thinking is, there are lots of gods. This is just another god making some kind of demand. So in Pharaoh's mind, the question is, how strong is he? Is he someone that I need to obey? Is there some reason why? Does he have some power that should make me take notice and force me to obey? He says, I do not know the Lord. His thinking apparently is, what has he ever done? What people has he led into victory in battle that I should pay attention to it? There's no record that he's aware of to make him respect God. In any case, he says, and besides, I will not let Israel go. He's not even interested in hearing God's track record. He is not going to let these people go. He doesn't care who Yahweh is. So they come back, Moses comes back with a slightly different response. He says, the God of the Hebrews. Which is a strange response, because it's essentially like saying it's the God of the slaves. It's not going to be very impressive, but at least he is tying it directly to his people. Tying it directly to the Israelites in a way that Pharaoh is more likely to understand. And Moses goes on to say, let us go 3 days' journey, so all we're asking for is 3 days, that we may sacrifice to our Lord. Why? Because if we don't, he may fall upon us with pestilence or with the sword. This is an interesting appeal, because Pharaoh's concern seems to be twofold. We've seen this earlier. Well, there's the other Pharaoh. But the other Pharaoh's concerns were rebellion, helping the enemy against the fight against Egypt. And the other is the labor, the work that they actually do, the economic benefit from that. If God were to kill them, he would lose that manpower. But Pharaoh isn't scared. Pharaoh apparently doesn't believe that God is capable of such a thing. He's not concerned with this, the possibility that they would be put to death by Yahweh. So he just responds to Moses and Aaron, you're distracting them from their work. You're keeping them from adding to the government coffers. So he refuses. Then verse 6 through 9. So the same day, Pharaoh commanded the taskmasters over the people and their foremen, saying, you are no longer to give the people straw to make bricks as previously. Let them go and gather straw for themselves. But the quota of bricks, which they were making previously, you shall impose on them. You are not to reduce any of it, because they are lazy. Therefore they cry out, let us go and sacrifice to our God. Let the labor be heavier on the men, and let them work at it, that they may pay no attention to false words. So Pharaoh, in talking to the foreman, the Egyptian taskmasters, indicates what he thinks is really going on. And what his reconstruction of things is that the people are lazy, they just want to get out of the work. It isn't a matter of God actually calling them. They just want an excuse to get away from the work. So his response is, we'll make things harder for them. We'll teach them to respect and fear the sovereign of Egypt. It's curious that he uses the phrase that they may pay no attention to false words. It's not the case that Pharaoh has investigated or even taken seriously the possibility that what Moses is saying is not false words. He has simply jumped to that conclusion. That's the conclusion that he would like to reach, and therefore treats them as such. Verse 10, so the taskmasters of the people and their foremen went out and spoke to the people, saying, thus says Pharaoh, I am not going to give you any straw. You go and get straw for yourselves, wherever you can find it, but none of your labor will be reduced. So the people scattered through all the land of Egypt to gather stubble for straw, and the taskmasters pressed them, saying, complete your work quota, your daily amount, just as when you add straw. Moreover, the foremen of the sons of Israel, whom Pharaoh's taskmasters had set over them, were beaten and were asked, why have you not completed your required amount, either yesterday or today, in making brick as previously? Apparently their quotas were hard to meet before they had the straw taken away. Now that the straw is removed, it increases the amount of work that they have to do in the same amount of time. And apparently it's just impossible. It can't be met. And so Pharaoh's response, the taskmaster's response, is to whip the Hebrew foreman. Verse 15. Then the foreman of the sons of Israel came and cried out to Pharaoh, saying, why do you deal this way with your servants? There is no straw given for your servants. Yet they keep saying to us, make bricks. And behold, your servants are being beaten, but it is the fault of your own people. But he said, you are lazy, very lazy. Therefore you say, let us go and sacrifice to the Lord. So go now and work, for you shall be given no straw. You must deliver the quota of bricks. And the foremen of the sons of Israel saw that they were in trouble, because they were told, you must not reduce your daily amount of bricks. So the foremen, they go to Pharaoh, and there's no indication of a spirit of rebelliousness here. They just explain to the Pharaoh that they can't meet the quotas because it was hard to meet the quotas before. Now with the extra labor of having to gather their own straw, they just can't do it. So the fact that they are not meeting their quotas, it just means that they're reaching their limit as human beings. And that it does no good, therefore, to be flogging the foreman, because they can't get their people to work any harder. And Pharaoh just won't accept it. Pharaoh says they're just lazy, 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 and refuses to reduce the workload. It will remain what it was. Verse 20 and 21, when they left Pharaoh's presence, they met Moses and Aaron as they were waiting for them. And they said to them, may the Lord look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight and in the sight of to put a sword in their hand to kill us. Moses and Aaron apparently had gone with the foreman when they went to address Pharaoh. It appears as though Moses and Aaron expected that this meeting of the foreman with Pharaoh might have some effect. So when they come out, Moses and Aaron are standing there waiting to hear what has happened. They apparently didn't know what would happen. And they're hoping for good news. They're hoping that Pharaoh will relent. And yet he didn't. So the foreman's reaction is to denounce Moses and Aaron. May God look upon you and judge you, for you have made us odious in Pharaoh's sight, in the sight of his servants. So they're putting the blame on Moses and Aaron. Earlier, when Moses and Aaron had come with the signs, it says, and presented them to the elders and the people of Israel, they believed. Now the foremen are saying, may Yahweh judge you for this. Apparently no longer convinced that Moses is a spokesman for God. Well, Moses' response, verse 22. Then Moses returned to the Lord and said, O Lord, why hast thou brought harm to this people? Why didst thou ever send me? Ever since I came to Pharaoh to speak in thy name, he has done harm to his people, and thou hast not delivered thy people at all. So Moses is heartbroken, because Moses had thought that God was sending him to proclaim deliverance to his people. And yet, from the time that Moses returned to Egypt, things have gotten worse for his people. It has turned around and been a curse on them rather than a blessing for him to come back and announce what God had told him. It's not clear how much the Israelites had retained of the stories from the time of the patriarchs, from Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. There are places in Exodus where it makes it sound as if not a lot was retained among the people as a whole. And as a result, the story that we have in Exodus is God acquainting his people with him, seemingly for the first time. It is a process of acquainting them with him, both making them aware of who God is and making them aware of what God requires of them. But in this reacquaintance, God has decided to put a few people in place in this process. Moses is going to be the spokesman for God. God speaks directly to Moses and tells him a considerable amount about what God's plans are for Israel and what's going to happen. He placed Aaron in a position of being the intermediary between Moses and the people, the one who communicated what God had communicated to Moses. Aaron passes on to the people. So he's put these two key people into characters, into place in this process of reacquaintance. But as it gets started, the expectations are not met. The first thing Moses says is, God is going to take you out of here. And you can just see the expectations rising. But the first thing that happens afterwards is the working conditions get worse. And as a result, the people start to reconsider, who is this God? Who is this Moses? From our perspective, when we have the whole book of Exodus in front of us, it's easy to look at the people's response and say they're short-sighted. It's like this long hike, and the downhill is coming, but there's one more rise to go over before the downhill starts. But the people of Israel, looking at it, all they see is more uphill. There's more suffering. And they see no downhill coming. So they're having trouble believing that Moses is sent by God, and that Moses is doing what's right and what's good, what he should be doing. Maybe these are false words. Moses, on the other hand, he has more information. He knew that God was going to harden Pharaoh's heart before the Israelites would be allowed to go. But on the other hand, he cannot help but very seriously empathize with the plight of his people. So as he sees things worsening, he can't help but turn to God and say, you got to do something. The situation is getting worse. The suffering is unbearable. You've got to do something to relieve the suffering. You've got to take action. And you see here the burden of leadership on Moses. He's been told by God to do X, and he does X, and the people suffer for that. That's a terrible situation to be in, but that's a common situation for anyone in leadership. Not always does God speak to leaders, but still, leaders are trying to figure out what is the best course of action. When they decide between God and them, what should we be doing? What is the best course of action? And go with the best course of action that their judgment can decide on, and that may cause suffering, at least on the short term. So leadership comes with a very heavy burden. But as we look back from our perspective and see all of Exodus, we can see that all of this is stuff that God's doing. Nothing's gone haywire. Things haven't gotten out of hand. In fact, this hill that they are headed for, that this last hill that they have to climb, it has a very important purpose. God is going to make the Exodus a very dramatic event. He wants it to make it something that is talked about all over the world and is extremely memorable, something that none of these people will be able to forget. And in order to make the downhill all that he wants it to be, there still has to be more uphill. So everything's falling into place. The suffering that they're doing now, Moses' speech defect, we can go on, everything falls into place. And God is working out his purposes, and in particular, his purpose of increasing his own glory. He wants to bring glory to himself. He wants to show people what kind of a God he really is. In order to do that, they have to be taken from the absolute depths of despair to freedom. Questions, comments?
Yeah, this is going back, but are the Midianites, Zipporah is a Midianite, they're children of Abraham.
They are related, yes.
So if they had obeyed the commandment of God to Abraham, they would circumcise their children as well.
I would think so.
So
Ishmael was circumcised, was he?
Right. So it's in that regard, it's striking that she is resistant to circumcision, because by all rights, that ought to be a practice of the Midianites.
And Jethro is a priest among the Midianites. You would think that he, of all people, would be aware of that requirement. Mm-hmm. Roger.
It could be that the circumcision didn't bother her at all. It could be that, just like, well, I've experienced this many times, where I have something on my mind, and it's been eating at me for a long time, and then this one thing precipitates the anger, but it's not necessarily the cause of anger. It could be that she was worried about her husband going to a place without her. She might have been worried that he may have told her the story over and over about how he killed the Egyptian. She may have been worried about that he would go to just die. She may have been worried about she may have been let in on the story that the Israelites were, the Egyptians were going to lose their firstborn, and this may have been a tangible sign. She knew that her husband was going to be responsible for the death of a lot of people. That may have been even better, too.
Mm-hmm.
When you say that Aaron spoke for Moses because he had like a speech problem, what do you mean? Like he just couldn't talk in front of groups, or
all we know is what it says in chapter 4, verse 10, when God says, and God has told him that he wants him to go back and lead the people out of Egypt. And the third excuse that Moses comes up with is that he says, "Please, Lord, I have never been eloquent, neither recently nor in time past, nor since thou hast spoken to thy servant, for I am slow of speech and slow of tongue." That's what it says literally. Most people take that to mean that he stuttered, but it's not clear exactly what it is.
So did Aaron do this for him the whole time, even while they were wandering?
That's a hard one, because later on in Exodus, for the most part, you just hear Moses speaking. And it's not clear whether Moses is speaking to the Israelites directly, or what it means when it says that is Moses spoke to Aaron and Aaron spoke to the people.
Because it made me wonder, like, when he came down off the mountain from speaking to God to get the Ten Commandments, his brother was down in the valley doing wrong with the people. So I was thinking, like, well, what if he comes down there and he's trying to gripe out the people, but he's got to use his brother, but he was doing bad too, so right. It seemed like that would have been an awkward situation.
Right. It was awkward. Moses spoke with his actions rather than his words at that particular point, throwing down the tablets.
Do you have any idea when any of these people get a clue that there exists one and only one God? I mean, Abraham conceivably could have still been a polytheist who believed that the God who appeared to him, Yahweh, had something special for him and was powerful and was going to be a big deal. But do you think Abraham was a monotheist? And if not him, do you have any idea when it comes about? Is it not until Mount Sinai that they figure that out?
Well, I have always assumed that Abraham understood that. Abraham certainly came to the place where he had enormous confidence in Yahweh and Yahweh's ability to do what he had said that he would do. For instance, the sacrifice of Isaac. Abraham's response is, God will provide. And in the New Testament, the commentary on that is that he believed that God could even bring Isaac back from the death if necessary. Whether Abraham believed that there are any other supernatural beings, is that what you mean?
Yeah, I guess that's what I'm asking is, it seems clear that God loomed so large in importance to Abraham that there might as well have not been other gods as far as he was concerned in terms of his actions and his choices and the way he lived his life. But I wonder if we have any clue when the philosophical, intellectual view caught up with his spiritual commitments, and that they actually knew philosophically that there really only was one spiritual being to deal with, there really only was one God. Whether we have any clue as to when that got sorted out.
I don't know, but I think the record of Exodus indicates that when the Israelites get into trouble, they question whether this is the right God.
Right. Yeah, I think it's pretty evident that they're not monotheists. I just wondered if you have a monotheist Moses against a polytheist people, or what's going on.
Well, I don't know. My suspicion is that Moses, I put Moses in the same category as Abraham, in that he may not, if you were to say, are you a monotheist, I'm not sure whether he'd say yes or no, but that for all intents and purposes, there's just one God. But the people are not at all in that same place. And that's the struggle all the way along, is their tendency to second guess whether this is the best God for them. They're still in the market shopping around.
You would think, having lived in Egypt for hundreds of years, the culture is going to rub off on them. The same with Moses, that view of life is going to rub off.
Yeah, we'll come back to that when we get to Sinai, but I think that's part of what's going on with the golden calf is they're saying, Yahweh abandoned us. Now we're stuck in the desert. What do we do? Well, you do what the Egyptians did. Worked pretty well for them.
It seems like though, David, that there's always just, I think it was very clear that it's the Hebrew God, or it is the God of the Hebrews, versus the Egyptian gods.
Yeah, there is this Yahweh fellow. And they seem to acknowledge his, they don't question his existence. And he is the one that provides them with an identity. He's their God. The only question is he really up to doing everything they need him to do?
Is the question, is it that they thought they were going to God, or one of the God, or that it was a God that was outside the Hebrew?
No, my question is, see, eventually, by the time you get God revealing the commandments to the Israelites and then the prophets that follow, they make it clear that they don't even think the gods of the other nations even exist, that they're even real. What's not clear to me is whether Abraham and Moses really have a clear picture that the other gods don't exist, or whether that they're just not important.
Anything else?
Usually when it says that, something bad happens.
Somebody gets zapped,
or there's some kind of, you know, something. This, it just sits there. And then God appoints Moses. That's curious.
I think what it's indicating here is that Moses has stepped over a line. But it was one thing for Moses to explore what about this problem, what about this problem, what about this problem. But then he says, send somebody else. And when it says God grew angry, I think that's indicating there you've crossed a line. There Moses has gone, there is just rebellion. There he's saying, no, I won't do it. It's refusal. And why he doesn't do more. In fact, after saying that, then he makes, well, I'll do this for you. I'll take care of it this way. I'll take care of your speech problem this way. So it's, you're right, it's not very severe. It's not like we see elsewhere when God becomes angry. Well, he almost died a few verses later. So God's willing to treat anybody expendable.
Isn't that sort of, I may not be remembering this right, but isn't that sort of similar to the situation in the wilderness? The people grumble at various spots. Doesn't God get angry with them and then supply them kind of grumbling about water? He gets angry and then he gives them water. It's, on the one hand, it seems like his positive response is an indication that I've made a commitment to you and I'm not backing off of it just because I'm angry. But the fact is, you need to understand the difference between trusting me and not trusting
yes.
me. You just didn't trust me. I want to go on record here. That was one.
Yeah, that's good.
But at some point he says, I'm going to kill these people. I am. Just give me one good reason why I shouldn't display the whole screen and start over.
Yes. Stan?
Another point that we might watch for in consideration of Jack's question is, when does the Lord make it clear to the Egyptians that he is their Lord and they are my people? Have they been given enough information to worship just one God as yet, coming out of their pagan theology? That might be coming.
And part of what he's doing here is setting the stage for some really dramatic actions on his part to show them who he is.
That's the purpose of that. 40 years, the end of 40 years, it's a really long time to undo what's been done.
The thing that I keep coming back to and when I read this stuff is, I know in my life I am so focused on the present. I forget the past and I don't know the future, so it's all the present. What is God doing for me right now? And yet when you look at this and you keep in mind the time frame, God works at a glacial pace. And things get miserable, and I can be asking God daily for take care of this problem, and I think, and a week goes by and I think, man, he's just not doing anything. And here we're talking in terms of 40 years or more. God's got his own time scale, and it's a different one from ours, and he's building into us the kind of patience that can last those 40-year periods of when it doesn't seem like God's doing anything. And yet, what we also see in here is God's working behind the scenes. He's got things going. It's just that we can't see what he's got going. Things are in motion.
I think it's interesting, based on some things that you've been looking at, communism and the depth of communism, you've kind of J-curve thing. What has it been? 3, 4, 5 years since communism kind of went down, and now everybody wants to be communist again because the changes didn't happen fast enough. We want it now.
Yeah, we live on a really... Our time frame is just... It's a very short period of time in which we live our lives, and anything outside that time frame, it really doesn't impact our thinking much.
Your J-curve would seem to suggest that... sort of volatile period of time in all of the parts of the Soviet Union that have come into the free market and that stuff, and are dissatisfied with what the results have been. Our talk about winning the Cold War and how we can get rid of all our weapons and everything, because all that's done now.
Maybe a little premature.
I think it's important to see, though, too, it's tempting to take the Israelites in bondage in Egypt and their suffering as somehow analogous to our suffering. But in fact, it's not really, because God bringing the Israelites out of bondage in Egypt is a fulfillment of a promise that he had made generations earlier. He was committed to it because of a promise that he had made. But we might cry out for all of our lives to be spared from some suffering that we're going through and never see God deliver us. His deliverance is really a part of a much longer historical story, not just having compassion on people and suffering.
And another element is, we're talking about the people as a whole, how he's dealing with individuals and their particular situation would be more similar to what we experience. A slave getting a day off because he's sick may be a reprieve that God sends along. That's we're talking on a different scale there. God's dealing with everybody individually. Okay.